Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Philosophy began in ancient Greece as poetry, as inseparable with the medium of the musikos, the poetic mode. And for that reason, I'll begin with a poem today, a poem from one of my favorite Jesuits, Father Gerard Manley Hopkins, you may guess. And I believe that this poem, among many of his, is representative not of a particular Scotus position, as he's often associated with, but let's say more broadly speaking of an Aristotelian outlook. This poem is called, "As Kingfishers Catch Fire, Dragonflies Draw Flame." That's the opening line, "Kingfishers Catch Fire." "As kingfishers catch fire, dragonflies draw flame. As tumbled over rim and roundy well, stones ring. Like each tuck string tells, each hung bell's bow swung finds tongue to fling out broad its name. Each mortal thing does one thing and the same. Deals out being indoors each one dwells. Selves, goes itself, myself, it speaks and spells, crying out, what I do is me, for that I came. I say more, the just man justices, keeps grace, that keeps all his goings graces, acts in God's eyes, what in God's eyes he is, Christ. For Christ plays in 10,000 faces, lovely in limbs and lovely in eyes, not his, through the features of men's faces." So there you have it, one of Hopkins' great sonnets and a fitting compendium, a fitting complement to the study of Aristotelian natural philosophy and metaphysics, because I think there's much in that poem that makes us think, that gives us pause on the nature of form, on the nature of essay, which we'll get to, and, well, really, on the nature of nature, which could be the title of this course. Father Ambrose, in giving me the blank check of a broad title, should know it's one I've cashed. He asked me to present on nature and the natural, and so I have decided to focus this first talk more on fundamental principles and the notion of endoxa or doxography that we find in Aquinas. And then in the second talk, to go a bit more deeply on a particular angle of approaching Aquinas' metaphysics. And so that will be this afternoon. But beginning more with basics and introducing some of these core concepts we associate with Aquinas, like form and substance and essence, the act of being. Nature and the natural, as Father Ambrose mentioned, is a fitting topic because it can span so many different areas, otherwise perhaps siloed to themselves. There is, though, an intrinsic difficulty about approaching a topic that is so broad as nature. It's a bit like trying to describe to a man what lies under his nose. Or put philosophically, it's like trying to explain first principles or argue for them. But as we know, as good Thomists, one does not explain first principles or argue for them, that is, demonstrate them, so much as indicate them, gesture towards them, assert them, give examples to illustrate them, show how they're used and necessary. So if that's the case for the principle of non-contradiction and others, it's also the case for the notion of nature. But focusing on nature is a good way for us to bring together these otherwise siloed aspects. We also experience something of a tension between the order of learning and the order of reality, a classic distinction we should always have on the desk, ready to employ, because it does clear up confusion when we're talking about what is more important, what is prior. While metaphysics is prior in reality, practically speaking, we begin with physics to formulate our own notions, so prior in the order of learning. At a certain point in our reflection, we become capable of appreciating properly metaphysical notions. So it's good for us to go back to the school, as it were, of natural philosophy again and again, and to think about the original native place of certain notions we employ so easily and so frequently in metaphysics. So I'm going to spend a majority of this first talk discussing what I'll call the correlative pairs, the fundamental correlative pairs of natural philosophy and of metaphysics for Aquinas. And that will largely consist in a close reading of a passage on nature from the Metaphysics and Aquinas' commentary on it. However, I still want to approach the notion of nature somewhat gradually, and that's why I want to say a word about endoxa. So that Greek notion that can be translated as opinion, but understood the way a teacher teaches, the way a philosopher operates, we should think about doxography, about a survey of received opinion of previous positions as a necessary point of departure for philosophy. We know that this is a commonplace in Aristotle's writings, that he begins his treatises with a survey of previous opinions. Usually the first book is dedicated to that, depending on which work we're talking about. But it's also a modern discipline, if you think about it, a modern approach. Those who are graduate students now, or professors working with graduate students, those familiar, more broadly speaking, with the practice of doing an advanced degree, know that one cannot simply think deep thoughts and put them on the page. One has to begin with the received opinion in that field. And so often the first chapter of a dissertation is the literature review, or put more scholastically, the status questionis. We can survey the state of the question as it stands. What has been done on that topic? It's important for us to recognize this is an indispensable starting point, and especially for anyone out there, not in this room, of course, but anyone out there who might want to contrast or set at odds a historical approach with a speculative approach. I mean, so, well, they go hand in hand. For Aquinas, too, he begins so much, so often, his responsios in the Summa, for example, begin with a mini status questionis, a mini survey of previous opinions, sometimes stretching back to the ancient Greeks when it comes to the notion of nature. That's certainly the case. So I think we should have in mind two different doxographies. And I'll say a word first about a contemporary endoxa about nature. What for us as modern folks living in the 21st century, when we hear the word nature, what are the connotations? What are the denotations that arise and come to us? When we hear the word nature, when we hear someone, for example, say, oh, I love nature, they're probably not thinking about, strictly speaking, an Aristotelian term when they say simply, oh, I love nature. No, they're thinking more of the environment, the natural world, being out in the natural world as opposed to the artificial world, as it were. And that's actually something we need to acknowledge, is what we mean by nature is better defined in contrast to what we oppose to it. So we can talk about what is natural versus artificial. Nature as whatever is not made or influenced by human beings. Maybe the whole ensemble of the environment or ecosystem, the whole world considered as a unit. But I think one of the advantages we have from a more Socratic training is the ability to call into question some of that contemporary endoxa regarding nature. And I'd like to just suggest this a bit as a way to begin. And I've been inspired by a recent book by Minot called The Story of Nature, A Human History, published by Yale University Press just last year. It's not an academic book so much as a trade book, but perhaps mostly useful for that reason. It's an excellent survey of how is nature regarded through these different epochs. And he begins with a Socratic, as it were, dialogue imagined with someone off the street, a 21st century specimen, a rational animal walking about. What are we going to ask him? We could say, well, is man part of nature? Is man part of nature? Does he have a nature? Do human beings have a nature? Because if we start with a simple contrast that nature is whatever is not influenced by human beings? Well, we should ask the question, the anthropological question, about man himself. Or perhaps an interesting middle category. What about domesticated animals? Maybe you've never thought about farm animals recently, but we can ask the question, they have been so bred and raised and are dependent for their life upon human care and stewardship. Have they ceased to be part of nature? Or less natural for that reason? How about, does nature only apply to this earth? Or can we consider other planets, outside space, a part of nature? Does nature necessitate life? Does nature imply that something is living and having its own internal principles of motion? I think it's interesting to consider these, again, perhaps provocatively, in contrast to, let's say, a conservation instinct. Those who make it their work to conserve endangered species at risk of extinction. What is extinction, we can define? They might say, well, it's when something of that species no longer exists. And if there's no such thing as a species to begin with, well, then things just come and go. There's only radical individuals. So think of how the conservation instinct actually includes within it a kind of Aristotelian notion, perhaps. The irony, I think, if we want to be very provocative, and who doesn't, you know, I'm not doing this on social media, so we're safer here. Many who rally for the preservation of endangered species would resist any notion that there is such a thing as common human nature, especially if it implied that certain moral actions lead to happiness and others do not. In other words, in contemporary man's understanding, human beings often stand as radically other from one another, a horde of individuals, a mass of intruders in a universe of pristine nature. So that's a word, a propadeutic word, about our contemporary endoxa. I'm sure you could add your own, perhaps the fruit of conversation you've had with others, realizing just how, actually, when you're discussing with someone, perhaps the Catholic faith, it's not so much revelation that they have trouble with, so much as basic philosophical categories about nature that we need to do groundwork on first. What about the ancient doxography of the sort that Aquinas surveyed? Well, personally, I think Aquinas grows more and more sensitive to the doxography of ancient philosophy, in part because he's exposed to more and more sources. You know, someone who we should always say his name and thank him for the great debt of with a great debt of gratitude, William of Marbeck, that faithful servant of the papal court, eventually became a bishop of Corinth, but who, thankfully, fortunately, before doing that, translated a great deal. I think he continued, in fact, even as bishop to translate. Translated a great deal, not only of Aristotle, giving Aquinas better texts, but of the ancient commentaries on Aristotle. And so one of the things that's coming into Aquinas' hands later on, from, say, about 1266 onwards, are the commentaries on the Categories, for example, by Simplicius, and the commentary on the De Coelo, which we know he read and benefited from a little bit later. So Simplicius stands in the 6th century, really at the end of the whole ancient philosophy era, and is able to sort of put things together with a new perspective. He gives us the sort of definitive status questionis of ancient philosophy on so many different things. And he put in the hands of Aquinas, through this Latin translation from William of Marbeck, a great deal of opinions he didn't know beforehand. And I think Aquinas grows more and more sensitive to that, more and more curious about it. And we see that, for example, in his commentary on the De Coelo. So Aquinas respects and uses to the fullest extent of his access ancient doxographies, including those on nature. So I think that that's something we see manifest in some of his later works. I suggested as a reading the very first chapter of the De Substantiis Separatis, when Aquinas gives us his own take on ancient philosophy, beginning with the pre-Socratics and going up through Aristotle. And it's an interesting survey. It's Aquinas at his most historical, and I think that's really, it's sort of surprising to see for many of us. And yes, the topic of that work specifically is the separate substances. So it's often also subtitled as a treatise on the angels. However, it also stands as a very interesting survey of ancient metaphysics in those opening chapters. And we see Aquinas, for some, a little too comfortable putting together Plato and Aristotle as a kind of dual ancient authority on metaphysics. But anyway, it merits reading. Just want to encourage you to read not only the whole of the De Substantiis, but in particular those first four chapters or so. So Aquinas, what am I getting at? Aquinas is sensitive to doxography, and he employs it. What about nature in Aquinas? Just to begin moving towards a more technical definition. Well, as I mentioned, nature is something like a first principle, almost too obvious, too much under our nose to be demonstrated and argued for. Nonetheless, its existence is evident to us. Another reading I suggested for the graduate student participants is from Stephen Brock's book, Father Stephen Brock's book, Aquinas' Philosophy, A Sketch. And so a lot of what I'm saying today is inspired, is following his analysis, which is following quite closely Book 2 of the Physics and Book 5 of the Metaphysics. Anyway, Father Brock insists that we also understand nature at a more substantial level, should we wish to understand Aquinas' true notion. Understanding nature according to inner principles, especially of act and potency. Nature is not merely the makeup of a thing. Preparing, then, ourselves to distinguish Aquinas' notion of nature from our own ambient doxa, or endoxa, the notion we receive, as it were, in popular speech, through common education, purifying our own notion of that word is a first step. And we see that nature is intrinsically bound up with properties of motion and change. And this is the case for Aristotle and Aquinas. Therefore, nature, properly speaking, does refer to material bodies. So it's not, strictly speaking, in the original notion, in the original Aristotelian notion, possible to talk about the nature of things that aren't material. Nature as environment, as the whole harmonium, as Wallace Stevens called it, the whole cosmos of things, nature as environment is somewhat foreign to Aquinas' world. He doesn't refer to the whole ensemble of things as nature. He does have ways of speaking about that, but generally prefers the expression universa tota creaturarum, the whole universe of creatures. And that will be more so the focus of my second talk. More on the original notion of nature, however, in Aristotle and then with Aquinas' explanation. It's best to understand Aristotelian principles, the principles of nature, according to correlative pairs. And I know that many here are already familiar with Aristotelian terminology, but I'd like to invite even the veterans to see how the correlative pairs are related to one another and how they necessarily involve one another. So even when we put on the board a word like matter, we know matter is unintelligible. Sorry for those of you that are having trouble. I just wrote matter on the board, that's all. Even just writing that one word from the Greek houle, wood, even just writing that one word involves us in a whole set of other relationships, because we know matter is not really intelligible apart from form. So that's what it means to be a correlative pair, is we really can't explain matter without reference to form, and vice versa. However, very quickly, we're drawn into another set of correlative pairs that helps explain this first one. So we can think about how accidents and substance are correlative pairs. And very quickly, when we discuss change and motion, we're drawn into the notion of act and potency. And I think this is something not sufficiently appreciated. It's not that these pairs aren't just correlative one to another, but for their further explanation and illumination, they require what I'll call this congruent juxtaposition. You'll discover that I have all sorts of ways of avoiding using the word analogy for fear that certain people might call me to the carpet for that. Is that proper proportionality? Is that Prashan equivocation? So more on that later. But you'll see, if I speak somewhat obliquely, don't assume it's merely the result of jet lag or the influence of Italian on my brain. There may be a deliberate choice to speak obliquely about some of these things. So even if none of the vocabulary I give you today is new, you might benefit from clarifying in your own mind the real definition and interrelation of words. Things we think of, perhaps, or use as synonyms, like essence and nature, really are best, at least in this context, distinguished and set more clearly in our own minds. Another key to discussing nature is motion, of course. The analysis of motion is what gives insight to nature. Agitur sequitur esse. Action follows being. And that's, in a way, one of the things celebrated by that Hopkins poem. Each mortal thing does one thing in the same, deals out being. So if we want an insight into nature, we're essentially asking ourselves, how can our observation of what comes out of a thing or of its activity, how from that do we infer its stable nature, its essence, its form? So it's really the analysis of nature and the analysis of motion that gives insight into nature. But it behooves us to think of motion in a very broad sense. We could do this relative to the 10 categories of Aristotle, thinking of different changes. The short story is, there's substance, and then there's 9 other things. When you change substance, it's a substantial change. When you change one of the other things, be it a dirty habit to a clean one, that's an accidental change. Motion, location. We might think of motion strictly in terms of movement, but it first and foremost extends to other categories. For example, quality. Changing quality is an alteration. Changing quality is an alteration. And we quickly discover that for a proper notion of motion, we need a notion of act and potency. Motion is an actualization of a potency. Something must be potentially hot to be actualized and made hot. So act and potency themselves, a correlative pair, but set in connection to matter and form, giving us an analysis of change. We can, you could start, I'm not going to, but with a very basic notion of matter, form, and privation that we have in the physics. But from that emerges one of the great fruits of philosophical reflection in natural philosophy, in physics, in the strict sense, is a notion of act and potency that then is taken up to a higher level in a metaphysical context, allowing us to do all sorts of things. You know, the notion of act and potency is really one of the critical innovations of Aristotle. However, if you're in the mood, I invite you to consider reading chapter 3 of De Substantiis Separatis, where Aquinas says that Plato had a notion of act and potency. And then he also says Aristotle had a notion of participation. No. And if you were an undergraduate taking an ancient philosophy exam, you would fail him, right? You got the wires crossed. Instead, if you read that text closely, you realize he's doing something very interesting, perhaps under the influence of some of his recently found sources. Okay, for a proper notion of motion, we need act and potency. And this is what allows us then to get a true definition of motion, that motion is the act of what is in potency insofar as it is in potency. The act of what is in potency insofar as it is in potency. The definitions Aristotle gives us are sometimes a little disappointing in that they may not make sense immediately. We realize he's done his own oblique way of talking just to be able to get the principle up to a higher level of refinement so that it covers all the bases. So moving then from a notion of motion to a notion of nature, we have in Aristotle's Physics, in Book 2, the classic definition of nature, a principle and a cause of being moved and of being at rest in the thing to which it belongs primarily and per se and not per accidens. I can repeat that slowly if you'd like and define it as we go or explain it as we go. So Aristotle's basic definition of nature is a principle and a cause of being moved or of being at rest in the thing to which it belongs primarily and per se, not per accidens. One of the most confusing words in this sentence is it. You need to clarify that it refers to such motion or rest. So a principle and a cause of being moved or being at rest in the thing to which such motion or rest belongs primarily and per se and not per accidens. So what do we learn from this? It helps us to identify or to zero in on the nature of a thing as the principle intrinsic to it, so per se, within it, that is the cause of its motion or being moved, undergoing some kind of change, in other words, alteration. However, it's not just merely being moved from without by something else, necessarily. It has a principle that explains the things that can happen to it and the things that it itself can do. So that's where we're zeroing in on nature. I have to begin with bad explanations first so that you appreciate the good explanations when they come. I'm not calling his definition a bad explanation, but I know I'm not explaining everything I'm presenting. Precisely to build towards this text, which I will focus on from Metaphysics, Book 5, Chapter 5. When Aristotle gives us five notions of nature, and Aquinas explains them with quite a bit of help, especially in towards the end. And so that's what I'll actually list. I know I could have given you an outline, but it would just have the five things I'm going to write on the board, so it would be a kind of boring outline. So I'm going to quickly list them, name them, and then we'll go through each one. So five notions of nature. The first being a process of generation. The second, a principle of generation. Third, a source of generation. Four, matter. And five, form and substance. Let's say more about that. So the process of generation, the first one, the process of generation in things that are generated. This can be a definition of nature. In fact, it's the one we need to start with. So nature, and this is where Latin helps, right? Because English doesn't always identify what we need it to. So natura ut generatio generatorum. Natura ut generatio generatorum. Nature as, I'm putting ut for being the various aspects of nature, nature as the generation of the things that are generated. So this shows us that actually etymologically, the word nature from nascere, natus, has as its prime analogate birth. This, I like that actually Father Brock, entitling the chapter on natural philosophy, just called it births. Comes across awkwardly in English, but it highlights the word that nature's etymology implies generation. And so for us, the prime analogate of nature is in living kinds. And as human beings, we understand the world by reference first to what is more knowable to us. And what is more knowable to us than our own nature, so to speak, than humankind being born, being generated. So when we speak of inanimate things being generated, we can see how that language already implies a kind of reference to animate things. So too corruption. You know, we don't talk about the death of a statue if it's pulled down and broken, or the death of a mineral. People do talk about the death of a star, though, actually, come to think of it. These, of course, are understood in a different sense. But it shows us that the prime analogate for us is that which is more knowable. The second meaning, the principle of generation, so this is natura ut principium generationis ex quo aliquid generatur. Intelligitis nevos omnes? Bene. Ita vel minime. Plus minus fe. This is a safe answer. Plus minus fe. More or less. So nature as the principle of generation, meaning, I'll just put the last part here, ex quo, that from which something is generated, ex quo aliquid generatur. So the source of its generation. So it could be the process or the principle. It can also be the source from which the motion begins, and that's what's meant here by the third meaning. Natura ut principium motus. Good to be reminded, at least as far as ecclesiastical Latin, philosophical, scholastic Latin is concerned, you can't completely ignore the fourth declension. Motus, quarta declinatio est. This is a fourth declension word, meaning it's in the genitive case here. So, how does that cash out? The principle of motion. The principle of motion. Motus is always coming up in Aquinas. So. This is really a repetition of the definition from the physics. That generation involves some increase, but with distinction. So think of how fruit grows on the tree and is separable. We could make a similar example out of an embryo. So these are the three kind of original, more basic and foundational notions of nature. And only subsequently do we arrive at something that strikes us more as the standard Aristotelian vocabulary, arriving at matter. So natura ut materia. In a special way, primary matter. Prime matter is pure potency, in particular, a potency for substance, for being a substance. We could call it still amuses me that in French and Italian, raw materials is called prime matter, because it makes, you know, when they're talking about an economic bump or say, well, the raw materials, it makes it sound like very philosophical to our ears. Oh, prime matter. But Brock suggests we might call it proto-matter as preceding. The philosophical notion of prime matter gives us a certain conceptual flexibility because we can swap in and out the latest theory, maybe not the absolute latest, but one that is satisfying within a scientific context, the latest theory of material composition. Since the essential notion remains, whatever we think the elements are, be they atomic particles, be they atoms themselves, be they however deep we go down, in a way, the key thing is to remember that in discussing prime matter, we're talking about potency. And exactly where we draw the line is maybe more a specialized conversation for someone trying to bridge the gap between natural philosophy and contemporary science. So I think of my classmate in the Ordinary, Father Thomas Davenport, who's given many talks on this. He's currently working on some interesting research too in that regard. But to say the more fundamental idea, I should say the basic idea to keep in mind as a Thomist is prime matter never exists on its own. You're never gonna catch it in the wild on its own. But even at the elemental level, you know, should you find earth, fire, and water out there on their own, just keep in mind that they have a form. So prime matter is never existing on its own in the wild. And that's an important philosophical conviction. The last notion, now arriving perhaps at what's more comfortably understood as nature for most of us, we have Aristotle and then Aquinas' explanation showing that nature can be considered as form. Form or substance. So I'll put both of those. Oddly enough, he lists five and then he gives us two in the fifth. Maybe to invite us to consider how they're related. That they're emerging out of the same idea. Here, form means not just the form of a part, but the form of a whole. And we see Aristotle emphasize that this sense is primary, because in a way it's the result or the end goal, the final cause, of generation, is that a definite form comes to be. So we actually see, if you're familiar already with Aristotelian causes, we see that final causality is revealed as most significant. The final cause is king. The end is first in the order of intention. And we see that form and final cause in living things are mysteriously interlinked. They're difficult to distinguish. It may only be a distinction of reason. Because the telos of at least a non-rational animal or plant or whatever it is to simply be of its kind, a flourishing instance of its kind. And so the exemplary instance of a plant, of a squirrel, whatever our favorite animals are, whatever our favorite plants are, it reaches its telos, its finality, in being a good instance of its kind. What about substance? Well, what is a substance? Something that can remain numerically one while admitting contrary qualities. Again, understood as a correlative pair, substance and accidents. So Aristotle's conclusion and repetition of all of these possibilities of definition is what's actually most helpful. Nonetheless, we need to go through it lest we forget just how bound up nature is with motion and with generation and with material bodies. So we need to go through those first three. You can have me on record. You need to do natural philosophy first before you can really do metaphysics safely on your own, as it were. Aristotle's conclusion is what's most helpful. When we consider all the different possible meanings of nature, form emerges as the central meaning. So this dialectical list of options concludes with an arrangement in something like a pattern of Aristotelian analogy, what we could call proto-analogy in Aristotle, known as pros-hen equivocation. That, in other words, an ensemble of focal meaning, and his example is health. It's more of a logical matter when he's talking about that, but with regard to health, we say that walking is healthy, a salad is healthy, urine is healthy, okay, but these are all very different. One as a cause, one as a sign, etc. In a similar way here, we have nature, but it's true that the focal meaning must be form. And so both he and Aquinas explain this, that matter, for example, is called nature sometimes, precisely in view of its receptivity to substantial form. Form is the key. Why is a process of generation or growth called nature? So again, senses 1 through 3 on the board. Well, because generations come from something with a form and are ordered to a form. Generations don't just flow from form, they're ordered to it. So even in the case of, let's say, reproduction of plants, we can understand, you know, the spreading of the seed, that seed germinating in another place, it is a propagation of that form, the extension of the form beyond itself. So while plants aren't self-moving, they do promote their form outward. The species or substance of a thing is also called nature because it is the end goal of generation. So form is always the cause of motion, even if it's only potential. Form is the cause of motion. So When we get back to the correlative pairs, I'll show you that. But just to know the six words currently in play: matter, form; accident, substance; potency, act. And then on the metaphysical horizon, we have already shining a notion of essence. We should be careful to note what has and hasn't been said. We've said that a thing's nature is its substance, but that doesn't mean that having a substance implies something has a nature. So there can be substances without nature, strictly speaking. Strictly speaking, yes, but in a metaphorical and extended sense, we can call other substances natures. What has a nature in a strict sense, in the original Aristotelian sense? Something generated, and something with intrinsic principles of motion and rest. If form, that is substantial form, is the best meaning of nature, then why do we have to go through all this business about motion and generation that I've spent all this time on? Well, because these things are better known to us. We need to spend all this time considering motion. Again, action follows being, and we come to know a thing's nature from its visible and manifest activity. Activity is dealing out being. Each mortal thing does one thing in the same. It deals out being. So as a result of its form, as a result of its substance, it acts. This also connects us to the notion of act and potency, that a thing does not need to have motion in act at every given moment in order to have a nature. It may have a nature and never manifest certain things, and yet nonetheless still possess that nature. So reflecting a bit further on the notion of substantial form, we can say that both in Aristotle's text and Aquinas' commentary, substance and form get somewhat thrown together at the end, but we should think through them a bit more carefully. We're invited to consider the notion of substantial form and in so doing gesture towards a more properly metaphysical notion. We should consider that a thing has being through its form. It's a more intrinsic and proper principle of nature than others. So remembering our correlative pairs, I'm going to erase the current setup and bring out the pairs again. I think whiteboards and professors have a special rapport, like cats and dogs. Wherever you are, whatever country you're in, as a teacher, you always fear fighting with the whiteboard. So let's remember: matter, form; accidents, substance; act, let's put potency on the top. Then we have room to grow now. One of the reasons I've drawn these, I don't want you to think of these as mathematical ratios, but in a looser, more flexible sense, because actually, one of the things we can do is indicate something by putting certain members of each pair on the top and others on the bottom. And we might actually change that around depending on what we're thinking. There's a way in which accidents, though lesser than a substance, are perfective. And if we wanted to highlight the things that are perfective, we could put accident on the top and form on the top at a certain level. There's also another discussion we could have. We were talking about participation, and Aquinas does do that and uses these examples in the De Hebdomadibus commentary in particular, talking about Boethius, commenting on Boethius on participation. I'm not trying to do that right now. Just want to put all of these words in play and to show us, first of all, that he clearly prefers, in terms of the best definition of nature, he clearly prefers the notion of form and of substance to matter and accident. That's what I'm trying to conclude here. Having this kind of schematized in our head certainly helps. Potency and act, again, as a necessary component to this whole network of correlative pairs, because it allows us to account for change. So moving then to a thing has being through its form. We might call form a kind of unitive energy, form is present in all parts equally of a hylomorphic composite, it causes the thing to be one and to be united in its being, a unity of activity. It gives a certain strength of being, a virtus ascendi. So considering motion and the motion proper to a given nature, we apply these notions in a more basic way to substantial form. Even before a thing acts or acts visibly, it is. We almost always imagine form acting to hold a thing in being. So we need to be aware, again, of our tendency. I say again like you've been with me for years, but no, if I say again, it's just because I was thinking it earlier, not necessarily that I said it. We need to be aware of our tendency to reify things as we parse them out conceptually. And Father Brock has, the best phrase for this, he calls it Lego metaphysics. If we think that, well, I'm just going to hold the form here and the matter, and I put them together, there you go, I've got a hylomorphic composite. When we think about things and distinguish them conceptually, we then have this notion to make them things, to reify them, Latin res, thing. We need to understand we're doing that. We can't help but do that. But that's the nature of doing philosophy in this way. We think of bad examples first, and then we tell you why they're bad. Because the good examples are not immediately available to us. And they may not really exist at all, because we're thinking in terms of matter. You know, we're just troubled rational animals who have to revert to a phantasm every time we think, thereby leaving us completely dependent on this body in order even to have a concept. What a life. What a life as the horizon of creation, bridging the spiritual and material domains. We'll do some questions after, okay? No, but maybe we could figure out a better place to put it. We can move it to this side, just in justice, if you want. Maybe from the next one. We'll make it undergo the change of locomotion. So one of the ways to really appreciate form, I think, is by considering the artistic breakthrough of Rodin, the sculptor, because his sort of life-defining, career-defining change took place when he was working on a kind of assembly line of architectural motifs. There were these plants or leaves. And so it's just a basic embellishment added to the exterior of a building. And he was charged, you know, quite mind-numbingly with creating the same thing again and again. And one of his colleagues says, no, you're doing it wrong. You're simply copying what you see. You need to present that leaf or whatever plant it was, as pushing out from within. Because that's the notion of form. Emerging out from within, right? Conveying, and what a powerful sculpture like his, like many others we could point to from antiquity, from the Renaissance, a good sculpture looks as though it's alive, right? While knowing it's technically just an accidental form that a statue has. We know that representing artistically is having some, a good artist has some purchase on the reality that we perceive as rational agents. And so the notion of form pushing out from within, and you know, if you can understand his sculpture subsequent to that, his mature career, if you go to the Rodin Museum in Paris, for example, you see that you can't help, you're almost confronted by the vitality of form pushing out from within the sculpture towards you. That helps us have some purchase on the notion of form. I think the artistic analogies are useful for us, and they help us see that, you know, beauty is not unimportant, and our recognition of beauty is not unimportant in the philosophical project. For some, like Plato, it's absolutely foundational. We can think of how, for example, in the Phaedrus, it's the acknowledgement of beauty that allows one to actually have knowledge of the forms, or that connects one previously to one's experience of the forms. Going back to Father Hopkins, in a different poem, when he sort of celebrates the beauty of what he witnesses in a wind hover, which is this type of kite, meaning a bird, that can actually maintain, in flying into the wind, it can stay stationary and hunt over the field mice just by all of these split second movements that it's making with its wings, with its tail. And so it's really something to behold. And he has this, what he deemed to be his favorite, his best poem, The Wind Hover, celebrating the beauty of this bird. And he's, in one phrase he says, "My heart in hiding stirred for a bird." Which has something of an echo of the Phaedrus in it, the soul growing wings at the sight of a beautiful form. So then he continues, "Brute beauty and valor and act." You know, as one educated in a scholastic tradition, he had a vivid notion of act. And a lot of his poems aren't this sort of romanticism of nature so much as a recognition, this resonance between the scholastic philosophy he learned and what he saw in the Welsh countryside. And so I think that's inspirational for us, that actually having something of an aesthetic experience can be our way to gain purchase on what form really is. So I've given the Rodin example and Hopkins. Again, a different poem, Hopkins talking about beauty. Why have beauty? If beauty gets people into so much trouble, why does God make beautiful things? "To keep men's wits warm to the things that are." To keep men's wits warm to the things that are. In other words, so that our minds pay attention to being. And we know in something of the, you got to get people out of the cave somehow, right? They're holding the cave in their own hands now with their smartphone, but they need to see something more beautiful, right, in order to have an insight into the truth. And so this isn't just a technical world in which these scholastic concepts exist. In fact, what we maintain is not just that one can have a system where all these terms work together, but rather, actually, this is the best account we have for describing the world we all live in. No, these concepts, whatever words we apply to them, whatever language we're speaking, are real. And beginning to use them as a way to gain purchase on reality is also a way to keep people grounded, to put their feet back on this earth. And from that can proceed many other conversations about natural law and other things. So I have just a little bit more left in this first lecture, and then we'll have hopefully some time for questions. So substantial form is not the same as a particular substance, nor is it the same as kind. Substantial form is a principle of being. Species or kind implies the complete package of matter and form. Form is a principle. While the human soul, for example, is the substantial form of the human body, you are not merely your soul. And this is true, too, of non-rational animals. They can't be reduced to their substantial form. Perhaps it's easiest to see this by contrast. Substantial form does not equal kind or species. However, the definition, an essence, the definition of an essence of a species expresses both matter and form, at least in things composed of matter and form, aka leave the angels aside for a moment. So in things composed of matter and form, the definition or the essence expresses that full composite. So what am I doing? I'm just wanting you to associate certain terms, but to make sure you don't immediately identify them as the same, meaning the same things. Really what we're building towards is a notion of essence, which you may have guessed it is the next on our hangman gain up here, that we actually can put essence and essay as another correlative pair. Essence and essay being the Latin word for the verb to be, but here indicating an act of being, the thing's act of being and its kind, and its species. So in material things, the notion of essence includes within it, as I've said, matter and form, the hylomorphic composition. But in this further properly metaphysical pair of essence and esse, we arrive at a more mature notion. And what I want to make sure, you kind of have clear in your mind that essence can be called a nature, but we want to distinguish it a bit. Aquinas says we're speaking metaphorically if we call essence a nature. We're naming the part by the whole. We're naming the whole by the part, an instance of metonymy. So rather than using essence and nature interchangeably, it's perhaps best to use essence and species interchangeably. Now, when I say species, I suspect two things come to people's mind. The biological taxonomy of genus and species, or those more philosophically minded, perhaps the Porphyrian tree in logic, when things are identified according to genus and specific difference. If we leave aside biological taxonomy for a moment, we can talk about the logical notion of genus and species. And I'll go into that in more detail in a second, but just to say now that species is associated with definition, but it's not the mere definition. It signifies, it refers to a reality that's signified by that term. I suspect that when we're playing fast and loose, even among Thomists, we often hear nature used as a synonym with the notion of essence. Hopefully you can see by now that it's a bit more to the story. Nature is truly bound up with material bodies and more properly describes their status as generated and the principle of their rest and motion, or the principle of their generation. As Aristotle and Aquinas both note, there's good reason these terms are difficult to separate, that they get confused or they're used sort of casually, sometimes in a synonymous way. I'm not making these distinctions to play the role of Thomistic language police, which I'm not really interested in doing. Rather, to help you be more sensitive to these distinctions in Aquinas, so that when you do approach his text, you're less likely to get confused and import neither a contemporary notion of nature in, nor, let's say, a more confused notion. We want to hopefully refine things to a more metaphysical level, and we'll be able to do that in the second talk, especially as we explore essence and esse, and the notion, the metaphysical notion of species as distinct from the logical notion. But that's enough for now.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.